Hello, this is Deborah Harper, president of Psych Journey, www.psychjourney.com. Welcome to the Psych Journey podcast. Irene Spencer grew up in a fundamentalist Mormon family, the 13th of 31 children, so it was no surprise that she found herself at 16 years of age in a plural marriage, sharing her husband with her half-sister. Ms. Spencer, author of Shattered Dreams, My Life as a Polygamist Wife, published by Center Street, will share her experience of 28 years of polygamous marriage and how she and her children managed to escape. Irene lives in Anchorage, Alaska, with her faithful husband of 20 years, Hector J. Spencer, who never leaves her side. At 84 years of age, Hector travels with Irene, proudly basking in her recent newfound success. They currently reside in Woodridge, California, with Irene's oldest daughter, where Irene continues to write and work on various projects. Irene's number one love is her family, so when she's not writing or speaking, she's on the road, traveling the globe from Alaska to Mexico, Idaho, California, Minnesota, and beyond to visit her family forest. Irene attends as many new births, birthdays, weddings, etc. as possible. Despite the demands on her time to fulfill her speaking engagement, Irene finds time to continue her writing and spend time with her family. With plans to author additional books, Irene just smiles when asked when she will take time to rest and responds, "When I'm 6 feet under." Her next book, titled Be To Be Determined, will be available in May of 2009. Visit Ms. Spencer's website at www.irenespencerbooks.com. Welcome, Irene.
Hi, good morning.
Well, Irene, your story is just so fascinating and compelling and heart-wrenching also. So could you tell us a little bit about your background? And many of our listeners will be unfamiliar with the term Mormon polygamous. Could you explain what this means?
Well, in the about 1830, when Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, began his church, why they introduced polygamy. But today, the mainstream Mormon church does not uphold polygamy. They gave it up in 1890 so that they could become a state. But the people were taught that it was essential for their salvation. So many people said, hey, we'll go to hell if we don't live it. So they went on underneath the radar in secrecy and carried on plural marriage, and they became known as the fundamentalists. And there's many of them all throughout the Western United States. They think that there's close to between 80 to 100,000 people still living polygamy.
Oh, my goodness. Now, by polygamy, for some of our listeners might not be familiar with what that term means. Could you explain it for us?
Well, polygamy means that you have more than one wife. And these men in plural marriage, they call it plural marriage because it's more than one. And it's also referred to as the principle. And we were taught that we had to live the principle. And many men, I knew men that had up to 30, 40, 80 wives.
I'm sorry, did you say 30, 40 to 80 wives?
80 wives, and yes, and today...
Oh, my goodness.
Today, there's Colorado City, their prophet there, they have an estimate that he had 180, but it's absolutely ridiculous. It's abuse in every sense of the word.
Oh, that certainly came out clearly in your book, and this is referred to as the principle.
Yes, uh-huh.
And when you were describing your childhood, if you could tell us a little about that, it sounds like the principle really seemed to define most things in your childhood and your family history.
Well, I was I said in my book I was four generations, and I found out it was really five. But when you know nothing else and it's handed down generation after generation and you're brainwashed that you have to live polygamy or go straight to hell. And so that's the foremost thing in their minds. You're taught from the time you're little. It's talked about daily. It's talked about every move you make that you will marry a man that will have many wives because he has a promise of being a god in the next world, and you're actually going to be a goddess. That's one thing that holds the women there and gives them the faith to do it, because they're told you'll be a goddess in the next life. You'll own your own worlds. And that's why they marry sisters, they marry cousins, so that they can all be together in eternity.
Now, was this also reinforced more by the isolation, that if I read your book correctly, that children and women were really encouraged not to talk to or associate with anyone outside of the community?
No, we were very close-lipped and quiet. We did not reveal each other's business. I know when I went to the fundamentalist meetings, you didn't even ask who was married to who. There were many, many women there, but you didn't say, well, who's her husband? You just, that way you couldn't know and turn him in because it is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And my father actually went to prison for over 2 years in 1944 for polygamy, and so it was a fear that we lived with that we might be incarcerated or we might be taken from our parents.
Oh, my goodness. So you really didn't have an opportunity to look at any other worldview or way things were. And is there also seemed to be almost a something where people, if they were persecuted or became martyrs in some type of sense, that this would bring more glory to them or
absolutely
encouraged?
Yes, we were told that, you know, that we were, those, Brigham Young said that when people quit being persecuted, you'll know that they weren't following God's principles. So we kind of wore our persecution with a badge. It was the only good feeling we had. But we stayed away from our neighbors. Most of our neighbors were Mormon, mainstream Mormons. And we just stayed away. And we were taught that everybody was wicked except us. We were God's righteous people that were to come forth in this time and age just to live plural marriage.
Now, how were members of your fundamental group regarded by members of the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons?
Well, you know, we're a thorn in their side, and they don't even like to bring it up. They're very humiliated and embarrassed by the people that are living polygamy because it's kind of, you know, makes their church look bad. But even today, they have a book called The Doctrine and Covenants, and you can read in there, section 132, it says in there that if a man marries 10 wives and they're virgins, it's not, you know, a sin. That is counted unto him as righteousness. It's still in their book today, even though they don't live it. But a Mormon can go into the temple and be sealed to a wife, and if she dies, the husband can be sealed to another one and another one, and then they believe they will have all of them in eternity. So if they were sealed to three wives on this earth, they still believe in the principle, but they don't believe that it can be lived now.
Okay, so I think a lot of members of the Mormon Church would find it important to put out there that they don't support polygamy and don't bribe.
Not at all, not at all. And I want people to know that these fundamentalists are splinter groups that broke off from the Mormon Church. And so they have nothing to do with the Mormons. But they believe everything the Mormons believed except more. They believe that the very first principles that were taught.
Now, it was really interesting to read about the roles of women and men in the Mormon polygamous group. I mean, women's role seems so incredibly constrained throughout life. Could you tell us a little bit about the sex roles within the polygamous group?
Well, you know, most of the polygamists, there's some that don't, but most of them believe that having children having sex was just for procreation, for having children. I know many, many women throughout many groups that never had sex with their husbands except to produce a child. And I remember when I grew up, my aunt was always telling me how one woman had sex 9 times in her life and bore 9 children. And she was saying, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that something that she's so godly? So we were actually taught that you could commit adultery with your own husband if you enjoyed it. It wasn't an enjoyment. It was a duty. It was to bear children. And it's a great burden to put on a woman.
Well, it seemed like there was also a theme throughout your book when you were just in situations that were, oh my gosh, I mean, hard to believe, on barely subsistence and all these children and living in unheated rooms and working 12 hours a day, that the one comfort you had was that you were being obedient. It seemed like women being obedient to men, and specifically their husband, appeared to be the major theme of a woman's life.
Well, you know, they tell you to be obedient and to never betray the brethren. From the time we're little, we're told to don't you ever betray the brethren. And so I grew up seeing young girls, 13 and 14 years old, married to men old enough to be their fathers and their grandfathers, and you just kept your mouth shut. And being obedient meant that when you saw a woman get the beating of her life, I've seen women beat so hard that they couldn't function for 2 weeks, you know, but you just kept your mouth shut because it's the brethren and they are God's people. I've seen women who have buried their husbands, and the very same night that they buried their husband, they were assigned to and married to another man the same night. And I've seen abuse, but you were told to keep your mouth shut. That's part of why I wrote this book, because it's time that we stand up and say no more, that we are women and we have rights. And I don't care how many generations a person has been doing something, it does not make it right.
So not only the women almost seem like, I hope I'm not being offensive, but almost seem like slaves within this lifestyle, that you had to obviously obey your husband and everything, that abuse was his right. And then in your case, even when a doctor told you it was life-threatening to you to have any more children, you were still expected to produce more children.
Well, from the time we were born, we were taught that we shouldn't let a year go by without seeing that a child, see that there was one born into this. And I've actually known women personally who have given birth to 18, 21, and my neighbor had 22 children.
Oh, my goodness.
And she cheated because she had twins. I tell everybody she had twins one time. But the thing of it is that it doesn't matter how taxed your body is, how worn out you are. It doesn't matter if you have varicose veins or emotionally you do not feel up with it. You keep on having babies after babies because this is the man's glory. And the men would brag about their children, I say like a notch on their belt, that to brag about how many wives and how many children, yet they live in poverty and they're barely existing and trying to get by. I have, in my own family, I had 9 nieces and nephews and 1 first cousin that committed suicide. And, I mean, that's, really high numbers,
Mm-hmm.
And when you see people that go through the strains and the heartache and none of your needs are ever fulfilled, and we came into this world to, to enjoy and have enjoyment, but it's just a rough road a hole all the way through for a woman.
Yes, and on the male's role, there seemed to be an imbalance, at least as I read your book, between the woman's obligation to have as many children as possible and then the man marrying as many women as possible and impregnating them every year. But the men didn't seem to be able to support these families. And at least in your case, it seemed like the individual wives were pretty much supporting themselves and their children.
Well, it is. Everybody, you grew up just to know that you had to kind of fend for yourself, That's why in my book I'd go out to the farms and solicit, coals of food and things to try to keep us going. And we never shopped. I never shopped at all until I left my husband and got on welfare years later. But we didn't shop at all. We just, he would bring clothes from a secondhand store that were thrown away, that were dirty and torn. He'd bring a whole truckload, and we would take those apart and save every button and every piece of lace. And out of the full skirts, I made pillowcases. And, I didn't have a pair of sheets for 17 years. I made them out of flour sacks, And we lived poor, just basically trying to survive.
Well, I remember one scene where not only did you have to give up your wedding ring, but you gave up your shoes to another one. Talk about give out the shirt off your back. Give your one pair of shoes off your feet.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about the women, and I will say this. They are some very good women, and every one of us bonded with our sister wives. They were there for us when we had our babies. They were there through the hardships. They were there to share what little they had. And even to this day, I just went for Christmas time. I went to Mexico, and I saw 5 of my ex-wives, and we're still civil to each other. We still treat each other good, and I'm kind of an outcast because people think that I'm a traitor for coming out and telling what goes on in these groups. But anyway, I don't have any animosity at all toward anybody that went through this because I feel that we were all victims of circumstances.
Yes, and it was quite moving in situations that literally I wondered how any of you could survive. It was when someone would get very sick or have a new baby. It seemed like it was the sister wives who took care of each other. Like you described situations where a woman would be under the most primitive circumstances with numerous kids that she couldn't feed in labor, and the husband's not even in the country.
He wasn't. He was gone so much of the time. It's really something. He'd be gone 3 months at a time, and then when he came home, when he just had three wives, when we had the first three wives, he'd be gone 3 months at a time, come home and give us each one night, and then leave again. And I was in despair because you'd waited 3 months for him to come home, and then he stayed with you the night before he left. So you've got to see him spend 2 days with another woman. And I tell people, by the time he got to my house, I was not ready for love. I was ready for murder. You know.
How many husbands did your husband, is it pronounced Verlin?
Verlin,
Verlin, did he have when you were married to him altogether? I lost count after a while.
He had 10 wives altogether, 9 other than me.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And so, am I correct? And I didn't get from the reading of your book that the community put much emphasis on the man. Okay, well, you have all these children. How are you going to support them? It almost seemed like it wasn't his problem.
Well, it really wasn't. People, like I say, just fended for themselves and did the best that they could, and money was so scarce. Can you imagine? My husband had 58 children. He had 29 girls and 29 boys. And can you imagine trying to buy shoes, just shoes alone? Yeah, and trying to feed them. But we boiled wheat and would have many times just have boiled wheat for breakfast with a little milk on it. You know, I'd take one can of canned milk if I was lucky and had it, but I would take that and water it down to like a quart and a half and for all my little kids to even put on it for cereal, you know. But we didn't have things like people's like tuna and Jell-O and everything that people take for granted. We didn't have that. We literally lived on beans and a little rice. Even potatoes were a luxury.
Yeah, you described getting potatoes where someone would have dumped them because they were so rotten, and
they were rotten.
It was a huge treat.
They were the ones, yeah, they were the ones that had come through that they were throwing away, and they had big piles of them to feed their pigs. But we took them home and cut the rotten parts off and left them in the sun so a scab would come over them, and we were just thrilled to even have them.
Now, the thing that I really wondered about in reading your book, because you described you and your children had to move constantly, and you went from, I believe it was Nicaragua to Mexico to back to the United States, from this house to that house, and you describe long hours, like 12, 14 hours a day of manual labor out in the fields. Were your children able to attend school?
My children, basically, some of them had a fourth or a sixth grade education, and they were taken out because they had to work and help support the family. I would take the kids out, and we would hoe in the gardens 10, 12 hours a day. I'd take at least like 15 of them, and we'd go out and work. I worked alongside of them to try to raise crops so that we could have something to eat. But I will say that most polygamous children, and even out here in the States and in all these groups, do not get educations. The boys, they're taken out and they go into construction when they're like 15 years old and work. And I will say this, that all of them, because they have come from such large families, they're very industrious, very hardworking. And even my boys, I have 7 sons, and even though they had a sixth grade education, my boys are all entrepreneurs, own their own companies, work very, very hard, and they have educated themselves, you know.
So that's certainly a wonderful testament to you as a mother, but is it fair to say that children who grew up in this fundamentalist polygamous society, that they're really not prepared for life on the outside, that if they...
Well, absolutely. That's what happened to me. How can you be prepared? I lived for the first 12 years of my life with no radio, no newspaper, no magazines, absolutely no contact, no TV, nothing. And then you're told that the rest of the world is wicked, they're all Gentiles, and they're going to hell, and you're the only one, so stay away from them. And I was unprepared to go out into the world. You know, when I left my husband and went to visit my sister Becky, I was 40 years old and had never even got a driver's license. And to me, it was traumatic, absolutely traumatic. I didn't feel that I could even pass the test. And I want to tell you right now, I only had a 9th grade education. And when I wrote this book, I just wrote it and gave it to my daughter and gave it to her for history. I had no idea that I could write. Mm-hmm. And I have just barely written my second book. It'll be out in May. And it has a title, and it's called Cult Insanity. Cult Insanity, Polygamy, Prophets, and Blood Atonement. And it'll be out in May of 2009. But I didn't know I could write, and I just started writing from my heart. And like I say, I'm going to just fake it till I make it.
Oh, well, you write beautifully. You write absolutely beautifully. And when I was reading your book and reading about your life, I thought, man, if anybody is going to succeed, it's going to be you, because overcoming challenges is just something you do. But it, so within the polygamous society, it's not considered important that the children become literate or have an education? Was this normal?
Well,
the children would just work in the fields or go to work young?
Well, you know, the small girls, the little girls, by the time they're 8 and 10 years old, are doing dishes and helping tend babies, and they actually grow up as little surrogate mothers with all these kids while the mothers are trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts a big burden on them. It breaks my heart to think about it, but it is. And then most of the men marry such young girls, and they marry them. We were told that they married us so they could mold us and make us like they wanted us, you know. And this is what's sad, because people, you give up your identity. You just totally live for someone else, and it's contrary to your inner feelings and wishes, but yet you do it because you feel like you're going to hell. And when you're placed in a situation where fear is the guiding factor, everyone loses.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if it's particularly your cult, but I've also read in general, I was wondering if it applies, that a lot of times the older men, which makes sense in a way, if their goal is to marry all these young girls and keep them to themselves, they drive a lot of the young men out of the society.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I myself have been a witness to that, and even in Colorado City, where they, not very long ago, they arrested Warren Jeffs. You've seen him. He was one of the 10 most wanted, you know, in the United States. He was their prophet there in Colorado City, Arizona. I have 4 sisters that were in that group, and some of my own nephews were run out of town, one of them because his hair was too long and he wouldn't cut it, and the brethren held him down and cut his hair and then kicked him out on the road when he was like 15 years old. And so it's true, they call them the lost boys, and there's literally hundreds of them. I know over 400 that have been documented that have been kicked out and put on their own, and it's just sad. But they can't function because they've been taught that if they don't live polygamy, they're going to go to hell, and they've been so brainwashed. And most of them, I won't say most of them, but a lot of them get back into drugs and drinking, and it's sad because they have nothing to live for.
Yeah, so that is horrendous. So you have a 15, 14, 15-year-old boy who probably has had a very spotty education at best, and even what kind of 15-year-old boy support himself, and then thrown, leaves his mother, leaves his family? Is it something that...
Well, they're told, the mothers are told never to consider them dead, and they're never to talk to them again. And that's what's sad about it, because they cut them right off. Even among the polygamous groups, if you're in the Colorado City group, I had 4 sisters there. They cut the relations off with me for years and years and years. We couldn't even write letters to them anymore. You cut your family off because you figure they have gone to hell. If they don't follow the leader that they're following, and yet there's all these splinter groups, and they're all got their own prophets. So everybody, it divides families up. It causes heartaches. You have nothing to even look forward to in life.
And if it's a situation, it just seems like in human nature where I imagine there's a great deal of power with being the top dog, so to speak, that there must be a lot of pretty rough politicking within the people, the men in the group who want that top position, and how they treat each other, and then the price that everybody else pays for that.
Well, even in Colorado City, it's been sad that the prophet has, when he's got mad at certain men and they wouldn't follow him, he actually took their wives and their children away, told them to never see him again, told the women not to talk to him again, and he actually took those wives away and married them to another man. Maybe he took 5 or 6 wives I've seen from one man, take them away and give them to another man, and just overnight. And some women have gone from 3 or 4 different men because they didn't be obedient or what, and they were taken away. They are like pawns in the game of polygamy, I say. They are pawns. And, you know, nobody will know the heartache. I actually stood up in 4 of my husband's weddings and gave the bride to my husband.
I remember those scenes. Oh, my goodness.
And for you to try to keep your cool and look the part, because you're being criticized, they're going to say, oh, she's not worthy. She's, you know, she's not doing what's right. She's not serving the Lord. So you do everything you can to make it look like that you are, you know, upholding God. But I tell you, it just totally rips your heart out.
And if you could go back for a minute, because I think people are, their minds are going to have trouble comprehending this. A woman who is married to a man and her children by that man, the prophet can at any time walk into her house and say, you're no longer married to this man. I'm trading you and all your kids to another man. And she's got to pick up.
That happens. That happens in various groups. I actually have the biggest group that's called the Apostolic United Brethren out of Salt Lake City, and they have the second biggest group in the United States, and that actually is my uncle's group. And so I'm related to most of these people from everywhere, from Mexico to Canada, all over. So I'm pretty well very familiar with every one of the groups.
My gosh, so that terror at any time, so... And it's all the power usually rests in one or two individuals or a particular family.
No, they have one person that's the prophet, and he you know, he'll get him a couple of followers, the guys to help him enforce things, that, you know, how they go. But they especially in nowadays, the ones that live in the States, and that the women, most of them have gone back into nursing and school teaching and one thing or another, because there's so many of them. When a guy's got 20 wives and all these little children, you have to be able to support them. So they do go out and they get an education, usually. But the ones that were in Mexico and Canada and even first in Salt Lake City, like my dad had 31 kids, and I don't think... I think that I probably had, I'll say five, and that's stretching it, out of my dad's 31 kids that graduated from high school.
How does someone become the prophet? You said there's different groups and different prophets. How does that happen where someone's the prophet?
Well, if you want to know, everybody that I know says that they had a revelation that Jesus Christ appeared to them and told them that they were to run things. And I don't know if you know, but in Mormonism, they have what they call the One Mighty and Strong. It's a prophet that's supposed to come in the last day and prepare the people so when Christ makes his return. And so most people want to be that big prophet. And so they claim to be the One Mighty and Strong. And they'll get it and say, oh, I had a revelation, and they talk people into believing it, and other people say, well, God's never spoke to me, so, you know, this guy's serious, and he's saying that God spoke to him, and God gives him revelations. And that's what happened with my brother-in-law, Irvel LeBaron, and that's why I've written my second book, Cult Insanity, because he actually rose up and said he was a prophet and tried to put down his brother who claimed to be a prophet, his brother Joel. And Irvel actually had 28 of our family and friends and people that we knew put to death.
28?
28, and I was on his death list also, and Charlotte, the first wife, and my husband, Verlin. And that is one of the reasons why we moved into Nicaragua. We were hiding. We were hiding with all our children and our lives. And it's really quite the story, but I could only, they only wanted 300 pages in my first book, and I ended up with 383, I think. But I had actually written the story. It was huge. And I went to bed one night, and I thought, you know, when people read my book, they're going to remember this murderous man. They'll never remember me. So I got up the next day and tore every page that had his name on it out of the book and ended up with Shattered Dreams. But I saved the other one, Cult Insanity, and I'm going to tell you all about that in there.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to reading it. Well, Shattered Dreams is such an incredible read, and I think we do need the background. I do have one question, though. Is it so isolated that a man murders 28 people and no one thinks to, I don't mean sounds for me, but they wouldn't go to the police or somehow bring in the justice?
They did go to the police. He had the most expensive court case that was ever held in Utah. They got him, and they actually had him in prison and gave him life in prison. And he was in there like two and a half years maybe something, and then he died of a heart attack in jail. And it's really something because we lived in fear. You just can't imagine all these little children and thinking you're going to be killed any time and trying to hide. Where do you hide with all these kids when you have no money and you're living in poverty? So when I moved to Nicaragua, I actually lived on dirt floors, got water out of a creek, washed like the Indians do out on rocks out in the thing, and trying to survive just to stay alive with our children. But we really went through a lot, but you know, it's been good experience, and it's made me who I am today, and it makes me all the more determined that people will listen to their own inner selves. Don't ever listen to anybody else. We have that, you know, the guidance within ourselves, and we know what's good for us. And we came here, we have to live our dream, and most of us give up our lives and live someone else's script, and it's so sad. It is so sad.
Oh, beautifully stated. Could you tell us what gave you the courage to finally escape your polygamous marriage?
Well, you know, you get to the point in life, I tell in the book, I had a nervous breakdown. I was suicidal. I was I literally had nothing to live for.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hit rock bottom, there's no way to go except up. But I came to the point where I looked around and I had been told all my life that I was going to go to hell if I didn't live this. And I looked around and realized I was already in hell. They couldn't send me there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that when I left, I didn't leave to find another man. I didn't leave to find love. I left to find Irene. I did not know who I was. I had lost my identity. And it was something that I had to do. If you read my book, I always had freedom. I always spoke out. I didn't want what was handed to me, and I always fought for it, you know, even though I was so brainwashed.
Yeah, that was something I found so admirable about you from the very beginning, is some of the quips that you even got off to your husband.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
He was always...
You could put him in his place sometimes.
Yeah, he just... I'd always have one over on him no matter what it was, you know.
I would not want to get in a battle with you, Irene. I would lose.
But that's why, in fact, it's funny because before my book was always called to me, it was called The Rebellious Angel, because in our group, if you don't become a god, you're going to become an angel, and that's what you're punished with, being single for the rest of your life and being an angel. And he used to tell me that. He said, you're going to end up being an angel and serving all the rest of us if you don't be obedient. So anyway, it was funny.
Yeah, you had some wonderful quips in there.
But, you know, I have 122 grandchildren
now.
Oh,
my goodness.
And about 5 days ago, I had my 48th great-grandchild.
48th? Oh, my.
48th. And I have a wonderful family. My children all love me. And the thing that is so wonderful about it is that I have 10 of my children that have come out and become born-again Christians and have come out of the cult and are living, you know, different lives. And it's just wonderful to see that one person can make a difference in so many people's lives.
Oh, well, I just find your story and you so admirable. And I think for the rest of us who really know very little about this, and I certainly didn't know there were 100.
Oh, yeah, they figure there's between probably 80 to 100,000 practicing polygamists in Canada, Mexico, and the Western United States. And like I say, most of the groups I know, and we're related to them one way or the other, you know. We've got hundreds of cousins, and everybody else is still living polygamy today.
Yes, and another thing that ran through your book that we touched on a little bit that I just found incredibly moving was for the women under incredibly difficult situations, and gosh, you know, that wouldn't be easy for any woman to suddenly have to share a husband with 8 or 9 other women, of how the women really supported each other and were there for each other. And it was really a testament to what we call sisterhood in a real sense.
Well, I want you to know, I can honestly tell you that I never fought with a woman. I mean, you know, hollered at her or screamed at her.
Mm-hmm.
I did at Berlin and told him what I thought, you know, but as far as her, I never did, any of us didn't. We never fought because we felt we were doing it for God and that
mm-hmm.
our salvation depended on it. And another thing, when he was gone, they were the only thing we had, and
mm-hmm.
we had to depend on each other, and there was a bond there. Even today, you know, I still love my sister wives, and we've all been through this thing together. And like I say, we were all victims of it, but it's religion's fault and that we've been so indoctrinated for so many years.
Well, it's wonderful that you were able to break the cycle with your own children, because it sounds like, do you have children of your own children who decided to stay within the polygamous society?
I used to have 6 people in it and 6 children in it, but now I have 3. And I'm sure that someday, I hope anyway, that I'll have 0.
Mm-hmm.
But working on it little by little. But people have to realize when they're so brainwashed, you know, at first they say, Mom's an apostate, look at her, she's gone. Yet they see that I'm the same loving, kind, good mother. And so it's made them reevaluate their lives and reconsider. And they've come a long way. They've come a long way.
That's wonderful. What kind of response have you gotten to your book?
Do you know what's wonderful? I have about 4 or 5 emails that I actually got from plural wives that have left, and that they said, Irene, you said everything that I wanted to say. I felt every feeling through your book, said I wept and cried with it because I wanted to say that. I felt that way, and I couldn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I found one cousin I haven't seen since she was 2 years old that came out of the woodwork, and I email her now all the time. But anyway, she was a plural wife, a first wife, and she just told me of her heartache. But the thing that's wonderful about it, I have people that are just women that weren't even in polygamy that say, Irene, you touched my heart. You made me so appreciative of the things that I have in life, and I can hardly cope with 2 children. You gave me hope. You made me want to think for myself. You made me want to be more determined, and that's the journey. That's the beauty of it. I tell people it's not the money. It's not even being famous for writing a book. That has nothing to do with it. But when you feel that you have touched someone else's life,
mm-hmm.
and you have made some kind of a difference, that is where your joy is.
Well, I cannot recommend your book highly enough. I just think you are such a talented writer and such a compelling story, and I'm very much looking forward to reading your books that are coming out next,
hey.
And I hope we can interview you again.
Okay, well, yeah, I really appreciate you doing it, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book. Like I told Donna, my oldest daughter, I actually just gave her the book for history's sake and had her put it away. Had no idea that it would ever be published. And she let her pastor and 20 women in the church read it, and they all came back and said, you know, your mom's got a bestseller. So anyway, that's how it started.
And your first one, there's more to come. So could you please give our listeners the URL of your website and the title of your book again?
Title of my book that's coming out will be out in May of 2009, and it's called Cult Insanity. Polygamy, Prophets, and Blood Atonement.
Okay,
polygamy,
and your book,
Prophets.
Wonderful. We'll look for that. And your current book is Shattered Dreams, My Life as a Polygamist Wife.
Wife.
And your website is www.irenespencerbooks.com?
Books, plural, books.com, yes.
And you have
I'd love to hear from anybody. I do try to answer every one of my emails.
We also have some wonderful features on your website, the photo albums and more stories. It's the website also is really worth exploring. And your wonderful granddaughter, who I had a pleasure speaking with, has developed your website and functions as your publicist. She's doing an incredible job.
Well, you know what? I hate to admit this, but I don't even know how to run a computer. I promised her last year that I was going to learn, and I got as far as solitaire, and that's about it.
Well, that's why we have grandchildren.
But she's working for me full-time, Brandy is, and when I take my glasses off, I can't see. So she does my makeup. She does my hair. She sets up all my book signings. She travels with me and, helps me sell the books and do everything because I do a lot of public speaking. But anyway, she's wonderful, and I just really appreciate her.
Oh, she's a blessing, and she's done a wonderful job on your website, so I really encourage people to look at it. Well, Ms. Spencer, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the Psych Journey podcast.
Okay, well, thank you.